Hi everyone, and welcome back to Discerning Consciousness. I'm your host Ants, and today I'm delighted to be joined by a returning guest and a good friend of the show, Michael Ronin. Hello Michael, thank you for being here today and taking time out of your schedule. That's really kind of you. And how are you during these crazy times?
Yes, thanks Ant. It's really great to be back. I very much appreciate coming on the show again. I'm doing pretty well right now. Been pretty quiet over here. Been thinking a lot about our present day circumstances and how we might understand and maybe figure out some sort of path forwards.
Excellent, thank you. So what I'm going to talk about today is, first of all, the metaphor of the Gordian knot and how we might go about untying or I should say breaking right through it, and really this idea of envisioning a new world, or the world that our hearts know is possible, because obviously that's something, a theme of your book, isn't it, Michael?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't really want to talk about the book per se. It's a book for conscious men. It's called Modern Masculinity for the Conscious Man, but at the end of the book, I also talk about our broader social and political environment and how we might be conscious men within that environment. And if it's not possible to be in the fullest version of ourselves, given the social circumstances in which we find ourselves, how we might actually go about reshaping the world so that it meets the requirements of men and women coming into their true nature.
I wonder if you could just share this idea of the Gordian knot and what it means in terms of the situation that we currently find ourselves in.
Well, the Gordian knot stems from a legend back in, I believe it was Lycia, if I remember correctly. And essentially, it's a mythical knot in that it's a knot which cannot be unraveled. And there were various challenges put out by, I think it was Alexander the Great. No, he didn't put it out, but he was one of the guys that tried to untie or slice open the Gordian knot.
Right.
And I think there was some sort of prize, if I remember correctly, for if someone could unravel it, then they would be gifted some sort of boon. And of course, many people, you know, it's kind of like pulling the Excalibur out of the stone.
Of course.
It's that sort of legend. I thought about the Gordian knot and the circumstances in which we find ourselves today. You know, the sort of world that we inhabit, and how we can unravel our circumstances. And redesign and recast and reshape this world into something that is actually fit for human consumption. You know, we look around us at the thousands of deaths as a result, not just of COVID and the vaccines, but also structural violence as well. The fact that we're living from paycheck to paycheck, most of us, how our food is unhealthy, how our water is polluted, and you know, the financial ruin of thousands of families, the very sharp rise in mental illness and mass formation that we see around us. The slums and the rise in suicide and homelessness, widespread social disillusion, economies which are in secular decline, both nationally and internationally. Looking at the masking of our kids as well, this is the permanent developmental crippling of an entire generation of children. You know, you can point to so many different things about how fucked up our society is, but it's indicative of a great deal of wider human suffering. And the damage is ongoing, and it's been ongoing for millennia. And, you know, it seems very much to my eyes and to many other people that what we're facing now is either our species being able to transcend its circumstances, or facing our existential decline and ultimate extermination or extinction. So, you know, this is the knot in which is tied around us. We are tied in the strands of this knot. And how do we unravel this Gordian knot has been on my mind recently. No, you jump in right there.
Thank you. I was just going to say, it really is a perfect metaphor for where we find ourselves. And dare I mention the C word, but COVID, that's just now another layer of trauma, you know, across the world, billions of people, that's another level of healing that we have to do. And especially for the children, it's just the trauma of the wearing the mask, as you point out, Michael. It's really horrific and symptomatic of where we find ourselves. And of course, part of all of these aspects, or the intertwining dimensions of the Gordian knot, is this idea of hope and fear, because that's what's really shaping our psychology. And I believe that you would like to share an extract from your book, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I guess I should maybe just say a little bit about hope and fear.
Sure.
You know, obviously we recognize that fear is problematic. And you know, we can sometimes react irrationally to when fear comes into our lives, and we don't think things through enough, and we let fear grab a hold of us. But the thing is, hope is also problematic, it seems to me. And it seems weird to say that, because of course, you know, like faith, hope, and charity are considered a trio of Christian virtues. But here's the problem with hope. Hope also pacifies us to like a dream that may never come around, that may never come into existence, by just dreaming of that hope. It's so much simpler to bury reality than it is to dispose of dreams which may have no accordance, or which may not comport with reality. And you know, in our conversation before we started the recording, you were mentioning hopium, and that's such a good word. You know, hopium stops us seeing reality as it really is, and reaching a dispassionate accounting of our circumstances, which may then point to a better course of action. So I guess there's a distinction between hope and hopium. Hopium doesn't support higher levels of consciousness and higher levels of awareness. You know, we're waiting and hoping and praying for a new and brighter world to emerge, and having faith that such a world will materialize, just because we want it to materialize, because we yearn for it so much, you know. And of course, we've been through so much in our lifetimes and in the lifetimes before us. All of us are yearning for a better world. And we, you know, and I've been listening to news reports and watching videos where, you know, one side declares the other to be on the wrong side of history. And there's hope there. There's hope that one day, those on the wrong side of history will be held accountable, and suddenly things will be looking bright and cleaner. And the thing is that hopium, I think, stops us from taking the necessary steps to make that eventuality actually happen. Sit in our little bubble and wait for others to do the work and to lead us, never realizing that we're the ones that we've been waiting for.
And so, of course, what you're describing, sorry to interrupt there, Michael, is the basis of Abrahamic religions, and also this idea of hopium, really, for those who have been highly critical of the Q narrative, of course, that would be their main criticism, that's all it is. It's hopium. It's almost like, well, show me the money. Where is this, you know, where is the evidence that these white hats are bringing about a profound change for good within society? And I know that, again, there's this idea of optics. Well, it's all happening out of view, or things aren't as they seem. And I think, yeah, I think that really, that's partly where the phrase hopium is being applied, the whole Q thing, because there are still a lot of people who believe that a big revelation is coming, whether it's with contact with the intergalactics. The elites have said to have stood down on their swords, or whether it's, yeah, they still believe that Trump's going to return. So it's a very powerful thing, isn't it, hopium? It's a very, and as I've said on my podcast before, about a year ago, I did fall under the spell of hopium, because I'm so desperate, like lots of you guys, to see a better world, which I know in my own heart is possible. So we do grasp on to hopium, don't we? It's, you know, we can all fall for that, if you like.
Yeah, do you know, it kind of puts me in mind of that experiment, I think it was, back in the 1950s, at, I believe it was Harvard University, where they did experiments on rats.
Yeah.
And put them in, like, buckets of water to see how long they would be able to tread water. And I think they sank after about 15 minutes. But then right before the rats sank and gave up, the researchers would pick them out of the bucket and let them rest for a little while. And then they would put them back in the bucket. And they didn't last. I mean, the thought is that, you know, they must be so exhausted, they're going to just sink in like 2 minutes. But they actually swam, I believe it was for hours, like 60 or 70 hours after they put them back in the bucket. The thing that kept those rats going was hope.
Gosh, yeah.
Hope is so powerful.
Yeah.
It's a testament to really to the resiliency of the spirit and to what we're willing to tolerate. But the thing is, I mean, like those rats, human beings will tolerate almost illimitable levels of crap right up until the point where we die, all because we hope our circumstances will improve and the suffering will come to an end. But if you look at it rationally, the experiments that we are subjected to societally never come to an end.
No.
And they never will until we stop them from taking place in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
Which brings us back to cutting the audio knot.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah. So there's a passage in the book which is a couple of paragraphs. I thought I might just read out to set the tone for our conversation, if I may go ahead.
Of course, yeah, go ahead. Thank you.
We're at an important moment in our history as an evolving species with our current level of consciousness. The level of dysfunction is at an all-time high at the same time as is our appreciation of it. We're now living during an era of self-destructive mass delusion, when the majority is pursuing and even cheering on behaviors that undermine its well-being. We have excruciatingly problematic economic, environmental, and political issues. Many are finally looking at how we can improve our condition in this world, and at the same time are contemplating defeat. For millennia, we've got on with the routine business of the survival of living, and now, more and more people are asking questions about our human trajectory. How do we regard ourselves, and how do we regard others? Can we create a good society? Can we live together, and how do we manifest that? What is the nature and purpose of this shared existence? Now, given that we all have our personal subjective realities, how can we cohere to create a unified whole? These are not necessarily metaphysical or philosophical questions. There are practical implications we can coalesce around. We all have a mind and a heart. We are inevitably, consciously or unconsciously, part of the evolution of our own collective experience that we call society. As conscious men, can we contribute according to our abilities to the direction of enlightened coexistence. In order to survive as a species, we need to take power back into our own hands. We need to create a new paradigm of collective and personal sovereignty. And we need to reclaim our own consciousness as free-thinking, free-feeling men and women. This means no longer seeing ourselves as subject to the authority of our rulers and revoking our consent to be governed. It means delegitimizing the ruling class and legitimizing ourselves. So that basically, as you might be able to tell from that excerpt, I feel that the preeminent question before us is the question of the ruling class. And, you know, I'm sure your listeners know what the ruling class is, or there are various names for it. You know, there's the deep state, the Illuminati, the globalists, the ruling elite, the one percenters.
Yeah. I mean,
all of those terms have been used to describe this class of a very, 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 very tiny monopoly, a minority of individuals who monopolize the resources and shape in which we live. They are the greedy fucking psychopaths.
Yeah.
Yeah. Use the term, who rule from the shadows. So a little bit about the ruling class. The ruling class is nothing but adaptable. That's how they stick around. They are strong and flexible. They're like the reed that bends with the wind. That they bend with public pushback when they test us too much, and we get pissed off about it, but they never break.
Well, that's exactly what's happening now with the COVID narrative. That's
right. So they're bending a little bit. They're peeling back some of the COVID restrictions as a result of mass protest. They're like, oh, okay, let's just ease back a little bit. So they're very, very patient.
Yeah.
And, you know, but when the wind is not blowing, they grab more power, you know, either by grabbing fistfuls of it in a very totalitarian manner. But more often, it's, you know, it's the boiling frog plan of attack, where they slowly and incrementally increase the temperature of the water in which we swim, and eventually boil us alive. You know, to use the analogy, but it's about chipping away at our freedoms.
Yeah.
The so-called democracies in which we live are actually more about chipping away at the rights and privileges and, you know, the welfare state as it's been since the 1930s, which was the last time we stood up to the ruling elite with any effect. And since then, we've seen that they've been incrementally peeling back the reforms that were granted to our grandfathers in those days. So they've been around a long time, that they have been organized in terms of kingdoms and monarchies and empires and dynasties. But in the past, historically, these days, they actually rest in a framework of more so in corporations and governments and financial institutions, like, you know, the Federal Reserve and central banks around the world.
Sure.
And they control us. They exercise control by creating institutions, you know, the interlocking boards of directors of companies around the world, you know, companies like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, which are the three biggest companies, and basically those three companies own everything. And I think is it BlackRock that actually owns Vanguard? So even at the very top of the pyramid, there's this occult nature as to who owns what and who is owning what. So they dominate national governments around the world, both democratic and authoritarian. in order to, and I don't think this is really a secret or a conspiracy anymore, but essentially in order to create global government, global governance solely in their best interests. And they have this coordinated agenda at a global level, essentially to rule the world. You know, it's amazing when you think that this is real. It doesn't sound real, but it actually is. So that's who they are. The biggest tool they have at their disposal is the economic system. The present version of that is capitalism. You know, we've moved on from feudalism. The late 19th century saw a shift to imperialism within this capitalist framework, which ultimately culminated in the First World War. Then again, they bend with the wind, so that during the Great Depression, as I said, you know, and the reforms that were granted to the people, this wasn't because they were feeling generous. Essentially, it was because Roosevelt, in this country anyway, I live in America, he essentially saved capitalism from itself by ushering in a period of state capitalism and, you know, other mixed economies. But then, of course, you know, that changed and people got complacent. And after the failure of the social movements of the 60s, we kind of entered this, what do they call it? It's not neocon, it's neoliberalism. We entered a period of neoliberalism, which involved dismantling and privatizing. And you probably remember this from back in Thatcher's time as well. This was when it occurred in England. Publicly owned wealth and services that were previously held, which were previously nationalized, and assaulting organized labor and assaulting the unions, subverting people's movements, you know, infiltrating them. In this country, it was the FBI. They infiltrated, you know, many mass movements of the 60s. And because of the decline of the rate of profit, they've been turning to the financialization of the economy in order to make money, make money, making money from money. So this is, our societies, I guess, are fabricated and socially engineered by this ruling elite. We didn't create them. This is an engineered existence created by them to maintain generally accepted narratives to enslave humanity.
I just like to say, that really they're like chameleons, essentially. And it's like the author, a modern mystic, Neil Cramer, describes the ruling elite, well, they're not really elites, but the ruling class, or the system, as empire. He just calls it empire. And over the ages, as you've been describing very eloquently, they just changed their robes. So going back to Sumeria, they've done basically the same thing. So at some points they'll embrace, you know, capitalism, then it's socialism, then it's communism. It's irrelevant, but it's just empire. It's the same beast. And they give us politics, which essentially is a choice between, you know, two wings on the same bird, as many people have said. So what it has is it's this longevity. And also the way I look at it is that the success of empire, if you like, and the system and the ruling class, is what they do is because they have control of the media and they shape culture through foundations and organizations like the Fabian Society, the Tavistock Institute. We know all these kind of names. What they do is they make intergenerational changes, but they make it seem as if that's just a natural evolution of society, and then as if we're progressing to some sort of situation where, you know, society is evolving and we're becoming more enlightened and we're becoming more progressive, and dare I say it, we're becoming more woke. that's why we have a very kind of linear, the way in which history is portrayed, it's like just a line that goes up and up and up, that we don't have the peaks and troughs of the fall of civilizations, which, you know, like with Atlantis, which is kept out of the official history books. So yeah, it's very clever. It's very clever the way in which they keep their control, because they just make it seem they hide in the shadows, if you like. But I think one good thing about COVID in the last 2 years, as I've said before on Discerning Consciousness, the mask has really come off and evil has shown itself, and those who are behind this evil, whether you believe it's, you know, these foundations ruling secret, the 13 families, however you want to describe them, they really, the mask is off, and we can really see it now, can't we? It's not, no one can say that it's hidden or it's clandestine. So in terms of, you know, cutting the Gordian knot, that does give us more opportunities, doesn't it? It is helping to, dare I say it, wake people up to the extent of evil. But yeah, it's a very good summary you made there of, the ruling elite.
It's funny, you'd think that it would occur to all good people in that case to, and this is what this conversation is about, to recast and reshape their world for collective well-being, but it seems to be out of our control to achieve. And now that, you know, the governments are backtracking a little on COVID restrictions and impositions, they're seeking to reframe the narrative so that they can keep people's anger and frustration in check, and so that people might hope, again, there's that word, people might hope for a return to normality, and they can then put their fears at rest, hope and fears again. You talked about the history, how this goes in, certainly through history and even probably prehistory, but since the Age of Enlightenment, the two principles that we've had, I would say, is like the two things have been democracy and liberalism, let's say. And there's a problem here. So democracy can be characterized as equality before the law, and liberalism is about the right of man over his own personhood. But both of these things have been destroyed on the rocks of present-day capitalism run by this shadow elite. And it's a fact that, you know, the majority of human beings have to sell their labor to a small minority, you know, the ownership class, for a fraction of their true value. So that what that means is that equality before the law is simply a fraud, because the laws are written by those who are in possession of the social wealth. And, you know, liberalism, you know, as I said, it was about the right of man over his own personhood. Well, that's also fictional as well, because the self-ownership means nothing when we have to sell our labor in order to pay bills and not starve. So what does that really mean? So, you know, I address this a little bit in the book about what a new political philosophy might look like. And, you know, it's not that there's anything fundamentally wrong with democracy and liberalism. And I resonate with a lot of what those two things are, but I talk about unity consciousness in the book, and as a kind of political philosophy. And how it differs from liberalism is that it views the full flourishing and optimization of the individual as a gold standard by which society measures its worth. The thing is with liberalism is that it's basically, you know, taking care of number one. You know, you want to be free to pursue your own interests and to pursue happiness, but it doesn't actually take into account the needs of other people. As a political philosophy, unity consciousness means limiting the functions of government to addressing itself simply and principally to the full, free, rich, all-round development of people's powers and capacities, and only that. So in terms of private property and common ownership, let's say, you know, I favor common ownership, which doesn't distinguish between those who own property and those who don't.
Yeah.
And it means that every person, not just certain people, not like just a chosen few, can access the resources that they need in order to provide for themselves. And when restrictions to accessing what they need are only limited by a couple of things, you know, the Earth's natural systems, when we live on a finite planet, so you can't just take as much as you want. There are physical limitations to that. And also, you know, adverse impacts to other human beings as well. So you're not free to hurt other people, whether interpersonally or by structural violence. And I mean, I know we're kind of getting off on a different tangent here. Perhaps we should get back. But, you know, under capitalism, you are born free, but then you spend the rest of your existence trying to rent back your life from corporate rulers. So, you know, freedom and democracy are not coextensive. Democracy is domination where the majority rules. And if the majority is dysfunctional or immoral or deceived, as many people are, then you have very poor material to work with. People who are ruled by their programming and by cultural narratives inevitably in a democratic system produce unworthy outcomes. And of course, mass man, who I write about in the book, but people might recognize more clearly as sheeple, which I don't really like. I don't really like to use that derogatory term, but the sheep inevitably lead the way in a democracy. They are the ones who comply with restrictions, who take the kill shot, who take the green pass, who take the vaccine mandates rather than face unemployment. You know, this is what it means to be a member of a democratic society. Democracy is supposed to be the pinnacle of a free society. And so when I talk about democracy, I feel very uncomfortable because it makes challenging democracy's legitimacy problematic. I feel very uncomfortable about that. Of course, because the implication is, well, what would you have? It's something more authoritarian. Sure. But being in a minority group within a democracy means that you are supposed to delegitimize your own needs and values for the sake of the majority. Take that kill shot, you know? And you have to allow the reality of the majority to emerge for the sake of the greater good. So, you know, I find it very problematic.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think the issue, obviously, with democracy is why it's a bit of a fake concept, really. In most democracies, people are not free because they have to, like you were saying, we have to sell our labor in order to have access to resources, which if we don't have them, we die, essentially. But if we were free, all of those resources would just be a given within society, and then people could really turn their hand to true and meaningful soulful work.
Yes.
I think that paradigm, that model, is breaking down more and more with the fallout from COVID and the collapsing economies around the world. People are being forced to to seek new solutions, to create work outside of the system. I guess the problem is because there's such a large global population, how many people can realistically do that? I mean, you know, we see these stories of people that move out to the wilds, wherever it might be, but that's still just a tiny amount of people, isn't it, who are living outside of the system. I think, you know, we need to have discussions about how we can make that the norm for more people. Otherwise it just becomes, you know, an intellectual, you know, masturbatory exercise, really. We need to have sort of concrete discussions about how we can liberate more people. But I think what you're alluding to as well, sorry to go on, Michael, is that until we change the bind that we're in, and that's the system whereby we have a ruling class, and we've seen since COVID in the last 2 years, a greater concentration of wealth in fewer hands. That's so this situation's becoming more extreme. And until that is changed, or until the Gordian knot is cut, nothing's going to change within society. So all these grand ideas that we have, they're never going to come to pass until this power structure lessens, because they're never going to become more charitable. These people are never going to become slightly less psychopathic, are they? So that's the kind of bind, isn't it, that we currently find ourselves in, really. And this sort of brings us towards what I believe you wanted to go on to, towards the latter part of our conversation, really, was maybe sort of solutions. That's what we were kind of beginning to allude to, because it's quite, I think we almost, all of us in the alternative sphere, we almost get sort of weary, don't we, expressing the problem. It's like, how do we go about changing it?
Yes.
And not falling into, you know, hopium. That's the thing, isn't it? How do we go about, or I know I've just fallen into these platitudes of, well, just change yourself and the world changes. Right. It's like, well, what's the reality of that? If I've got, you know, someone, the man from the ministry with his gun pointing at my head, if I don't take a vaccine, you know, it's an extreme example, but, you know.
That's a very salient point. I mean, it's kind of, in a way, it feels like we're in a rat maze, you know, one of these experiments where you put rats in a maze and they have to find their way, navigate their way across. And we are not the architects of this rat maze that we find ourselves in, you know, where you can receive an electric shock for going down the wrong channel, or a reward for going down the correct channel, the channel they want you to go down.
Yeah.
You know, there's this tension between freely made choices of individuals acting in their own best interest and in the interests of others, and the masters of the matrix.
Sure.
And they want to train us in this rat maze towards alienation and dysfunction. Sure. And, you know, for how long can we go on putting up with this nonsense?
Yeah, the shock almost is sorry to interrupt, the electric shock is almost, with regards to COVID, is almost social isolation. That is the censure you'll face if you don't go along with the collectivist idea of taking the shot because you care about other people. I mean, we're drenched in collectivist ideas, or communitarianism, or communism, if you prefer. Yeah. That's what we're up against right now. Do the woke virtuous thing for the collective and get your shot. Right. Or get tested 3 times a day, you know. That's what we're up against. And it's worked a treat, hasn't it? It really has on a lot of people. We can't deny it. I mean, there is a lot of growing opposition, which is great. But, you know, the hardcore of societies across the world, across a lot of the Western world, which we, you know, have the most information about, has complied. Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah. You know, normal people... automatic and unconscious existence is what we're talking about. There are incentives. I mean, you can look at the world in terms of incentives. There are incentives to go down the rat channels that they want us to go down.
For sure.
You know, like the millions of dollars for school boards here in the USA in terms of COVID relief packages.
Absolutely.
To get kids and teachers to mask up and social distance and vaccinate. That's the incentive. The disincentive to behave freely is no jab, no jog. That's the disincentive. So, you know, since the ruling class have the money and the power and the influence to shape our social and economic systems, and if they're left to their own devices, they're inevitably going to win, because we accept their agenda. That, you know, we go along to get along, we cope. But no matter how we cope, how effectively we cope, they will never leave us alone. They will never allow us to flourish according to the divine expression of our organic unfolding.
Agree, because we're dealing with a predatory force. That's what we're dealing with, a predatory force. It's not just going to have a pause for a few years, you know. It is intent, and that sounds very conspiratorial, forgive me, but it is intent on our destruction, ultimately.
Right. Yes.
Ultimately, as we know.
I mean, you were saying that, you know, people are looking to exit from the matrix, and I'm part of that mentality of, you know, what can we do? Can we set up intentional communities and create some sort of bubble of liberty, a little free state, a little lifeboat or an ark to float about happily on this polluted ocean? And, you know, I want to believe, I really want to believe that we can do that and that they will somehow leave us alone. And if we get off grid and create our own economies and our own cultures and our own living arrangements and have some degree of success, do you think they'll congratulate you and leave you alone? Or will they go on and apply their diabolical minds and try and subvert your little intentional community or destroy your enterprise? You know, what if they outlaw seed saving? What if they hike up property taxes to unaffordable levels? Because they can do that. What if they compel you by force of law to use only their digital currency, which is what they want to bring in? What are you going to do then? You know, or the many, many, many other technically legal sanctions to weaken and sap your collective energy. You know, they won't stop until we make them stop. And even if the whole world is fully aware of who they are, what they're up to, what they're doing, if we're fully conscious, in order to live freely, we have to accept their disincentives and accept poorer life. You know, like doctors who don't accept the COVID narrative of being silenced and censored and having their licenses removed. Now, those doctors are virtuous, but they are compelled to live suboptimally merely to remain in their integrity.
Sure.
And good on them. So, you know.
And face the social ostracization that comes with it.
So it this is what a five-year-old would say to me. My inner five-year-old says, well, why don't you just walk into their office and say, you're done. Get out. You know, we're not going to put up with that anymore. You've had your little fun, now please leave the building and we're taking over. That's what my five-year-old would like to say. Just as simple as that. You know, if you had a splinter in your finger and you showed it to a five-year-old, the five-year-old wouldn't tell you how to cope with having a splinter in your finger. Yeah. It wouldn't say, well, you need to hide your finger behind your back. You need to rub your toe so that you don't feel pain in your finger. You don't need to put your finger in a bowl of iced water to numb the pain. What you need to do is take the splinter out.
Yeah, yank it out. Yeah.
You know, a five-year-old knows how to cut the Gordian knot. But we try to cope. And of course, it's not easy. You know, we have a greater awareness than a five-year-old at how difficult it is to get that splinter out. But in a very simplistic sense, he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. We need to walk into their office and say, you're done. You know, bugger off. There are things we do in the interim. You know, we know that figurehead leaders are going to be identified and targeted. So we need decentralized movements for change, because otherwise mass movements which have a centralized feature will be infiltrated and subverted. We've learned this from history. We know that we have to speak out and question every official narrative. And we know to, you and I certainly know this, to explore the rabbit holes and the multiple tunnels of truth that are out there.
Sure.
We know we need to expose them and disconnect from the dysfunctions of the system as best we can. We know that we have to come into our own embodiment as a discrete and sovereign individual, healing ourselves from the inside out, parenting ourselves, dealing with our shadow aspects, integrating them. We also know that what works best is non-compliance as a first step, and maybe setting up parallel power structures, which has been shown to be the way historically, but which never actually succeeded in overthrowing the ruling elite. But they worked for a certain extent in certain situations at certain times. You know, simply existing outside of the moral framework, which is, you know, that's actually insufficient ultimately, because the elites own and control the resources that we depend upon. So you cannot actually exist within their framework, because they will simply lay siege to you because they control everything else. So, like I said at the beginning, I don't have the answer, and I'm this conversation is really so that I would encourage your other listeners to go and have conversations about this, and, you know, better minds than mine have thought about this before me, and better minds than mine and yours can maybe consider what to do next and how we might cut this Gordian knot.
Yeah, I mean, all I would say in terms of like the boiling of the frog and the attempts by the elite, their attempts at their coercive measures, if you like, their coercive tactics, they're becoming more and more crude in a sense. So that's what I mean, whereby they're coming, you know, evil is showing itself more and more. So as we know, for those of us who want to remain organic human beings, we have to accept that we might never fly again. Now, I personally think that in their hubris and arrogance, they thought that a lot of people would comply with vax mandates because basically they want to go on holiday. Now, you know, a good many people, maybe as many as 20 million people in the UK have said, well, screw you. OK, we won't travel again. So, you know, so we won't fly again abroad. So, you know, the more they pressure us, the more the onus is on us to push back. And, you know, I hope that more people will, you know, I have been heartened by that. It seems as if it might be that many people, as I was saying, in, you know, 20 million people who haven't been jabbed in the UK. So I think, you know, there is the more they push, the more people, I think, are gonna, you know, not necessarily go along with it for a quiet life, because that's obviously, and, you know, they want to still be able to operate in society. Because I think the problem they got at the moment, why they're pausing on a lot of they're in like a holding station at the moment, we're in a holding position with regards to the COVID, is because I think the original plan probably was to get to set off like a civil war type situation whereby the vax would literally physically start attacking the organics. I know that sounds extreme, but you listen to the kind of rhetoric that was coming out of Macron and Trudeau in Canada about, you know, how we're basically, you know, not even real human beings because we've chosen our own, you know, healthcare. And I think that didn't happen. And also the amount of people that are refusing is so large. Traditionally, when totalitarian regimes, you know, come to their end game, is where they destroy the refusniks, is where they destroy the people who are not prepared to go along. But there is too many of us. So, and the fact in the internet age, that would come out very quickly if people were literally being slaughtered in their millions. So that's why they're pausing now. So that's why they're trying to kind of extend the hand of friendship in a way. It is kind of like they're kind of thinking, well, how can we can't go full on totalitarian. I think they might disagree in China and Australia right now. So that's why I think there's a bit of a standoff at the moment. So I think with regards to COVID, there is, you know, there has been a sizable pushback, but it is just a pushback. And like you're saying, Michael, well, how do we go about creating societies where we're free from this oppression, where we can manage our own resources, you know, in a human way? We're still in a bind, aren't we? We're still in the Gordian knot because,
yes,
you know, we've resisted. But what's the next step?
Yes.
In a sense, because now what I've noticed in the UK media, it's all about the economy. It's all about how inflation's going up. So now it's the reality of, well, we're all still in the system. So we're going to get screwed over, you know, by higher utility bills, by a collapse in economy, by yes. shortages of basics. So they still have us by the short and curlies in yes. a sense, although we have achieved this kind of pushback, if that makes yes. sense. We're still yeah, in the Gordian knot, so to speak.
Yes. Yes, we've entered this period of monopoly capitalism, of course, with all this. I mean, certainly in this country, thousands and thousands of small businesses were targeted for destruction during the COVID lockdowns,
sure.
which has led to, you know, monopoly capitalism. Yeah. And, you know, we have modern day robber barons like Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and Elon Musk, to name but the most obvious.
Yeah.
And what's happened is that the interest of individuals has been sacrificed to the interests of the corporate or the ruling elite.
Yeah.
You know, and they have, yeah, they have us by the short and curlies. So if we are dependent on them for our survival, you know, we can see perhaps that they will bring in universal basic income, but it won't be universal and it won't be basic because there will be strings attached to it. We will have to comply with whatever they tell us to comply with. Because if we don't comply, then that universal basic income no doubt would be withdrawn.
Mm.
So even if our pushback gets even stronger than it is now, and say we are in a position to go after some of these people by taking them to court, you know, we've been doing this. People have been using the courts and appealing to politicians and taking to the streets for decades in order to reform the system. And liberals and social democrats have tried to manage capitalist economies, but they introduced only such reforms as were compatible with it. They didn't actually change anything.
No.
And so I would maintain that this experiment of liberal democracy has failed, and yeah. we should go directly to the root cause of our misfortunes and remove the ruling elite, like the five-year-old,
yeah,
because they are the primary architects to actually to abolish class rule, I guess, to use an old-fashioned term, to abolish it entirely and replace it with some form of direct rule of the people. And then to begin the task of redirecting the productive capabilities of society to work for us and not just enrich a rich and powerful minority, and, you know, reclaim our collective inheritance, which is our right. It's our sure, right sure. to live freely and harmoniously on this God-given planet of ours. It's why what we're doing now, you and I, is having this conversation, is because we want to spend time now raising consciousness.
Sure.
And the more people who see through the system now, the easier that transition will be.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as many people have said, God certainly didn't create us to pay to live. We're the only species that literally has to labor. Yeah. has to pay to live. And that five-year-old would say, that's absurd. They might use the word absurd, but they say that's mental, which it is.
And one of the things, you know, people want, I mean, because Nuremberg set the standard for medical experiments, people want another Nuremberg, but Nuremberg was just a local event. So yeah. are we going to let the power structure remain in place with mouthpieces replaced by other mouthpieces?
Yeah, it makes me so angry when I hear people talk on about that, because I think all they'll do is they'll throw low-level players under the bus,
right.
and it will be like a fraudulent awakening, and then the same people will be in control.
Right.
We can do better than that.
Yes.
You know,
yeah. And we have
we
to.
Really can right. do better than that. Anyway, Michael, we're coming up to on the hour now, so I think it'd be good to round things up by way of a summary, and obviously leave the audience, leave the listeners with some sort of hope, or maybe a call to action as well, because I think, you know, as you've alluded to, Michael, we all need to play our part in this process, and if we, as I know, a lot of kind of people in the alternative, in the new age, the new ages would say, well, we're in an ascension process, so these predatory forces are no longer be able to operate on the planet, so we don't need to worry, because, you know, humanity is going to evolve, and the shadowy elite, they will no longer exist.
Right.
I mean, you know, what's your take on that as we round things up?
Yeah, well, show me the money.
You
know, I think we need actually to start talking about exactly what. I mean, maybe not in a kind of a naive sense, not in the kind of like utopian sense, but what this sort of better world might look like.
Yeah.
And I've got the thought for me is that we need to start working towards creating the fundamental conditions where we place more value on the intangibles, like personal qualities and virtues like wisdom and authenticity and integrity and compassion and courage, than we do at current, which is where we focus on resource acquisition and we focus on status and we focus on power. All of those things are wedded to ego needs, but that's how the world is designed. Mm. But so, you know, let's try and imagine a world where we can incentivize people, not through a market system, where we reward them with money for, you know, the goods and services they produce, but a kind of an economy where we can incentivize the production of fully realized people, but not goods and services, but we have an economy which incentivizes the production of an optimized humanity.
Mm, for sure.
So I talk about unity consciousness in the book. I actually think there's a better way of describing that, which is synergy consciousness. Mm. And to me, that's kind of like close harmony singing. Now, the thing is with close harmony singing is that we're all singing together, but we're all singing in harmony together. We're not singing in unison. We're not part of a collective. We're not sheep, but we are uniting in song with each other. And that means relearning how to make love at the level of fellowship. Mm. And what would it be like for us to honor our differences and dissolve our separation? So it's, you know, what do we do? How can we recover our shared commitment to the process of collective intelligence? How do we do that? You know, I write about in the book a medium-term solution, which you and I spoke about beforehand, which requires us to embrace an age of healing.
Yes.
Physical, mental, emotional, spiritual healing. Like, you know, we had the information age, the steam age, the space age. You know, how about an age of healing where we actually devote ourselves as a species collectively to an age of healing? Because if we don't, we're just going to tear ourselves apart. So identifying what components might be needed for that stage of healing is also another step that's before us now. I would say that we need to be cognizant of the laws of life, the laws of nature, and what those are. I don't want to go into those right now, but there are certainly things that are deleterious to the human organism, and we need to design out of society, those things, so that we can actually flourish. Take away the things that are hurting us and put in the things that will heal us. And of course, it's no easy task, but unless we dream big, we're just going to be continually demoralized by our everyday existence.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that in terms of like where we're at now, as I was just talking about with this change in the COVID narrative, and there appears to be a kind of a backtrack from the globalist script that a lot of these countries around the world were reading from, if you like, a movie script. There is this opportunity, I think, for us to embrace more of these ideas and to begin, like you were saying to the listeners and the audience, begin getting together and just talking about it. Because just getting together in person and talking about these ideas, I think it definitely does help. And then it radiates out into wider society. Because I don't think all is lost. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here now, Michael, having this conversation with you. Right. I might take an early exit from this particular incarnation. Because I think, carry on.
I was just going to make a little sarcastic comment. Unless you and I are just totally immersed in hopium.
Absolutely, I think we do always have to guard against that. And I know initially I was getting a kind of like sense of satisfaction that they were pulling back and maybe we'll get some of our freedoms back, and then realizing, well, no, this could just be part of some ploy. Do you know what I mean? So it's a very uncertain time, isn't it, at the moment, because we don't know, certainly with regards to COVID. And that's why what I was just thinking before we came on to do this recording, how much, I guess this probably applies to a lot of people who are seeking have a vision in their heart of a better world, the degree to which I'm still following the news, the narrative, what's happening, and how helpful it would be to detach, how hard I find it. I think it's probably quite a common thing for people to detach from it all. And that doesn't mean to be ignorant, but to just, my God, how much I'm still tied in to all of it, to the story, to around COVID and all the twists and turns, and how I need to just have days where I don't go online, so to speak, and just to create a space for new ideas to come forward.
Yes.
So I think we've all had our noses right to the map of life, haven't we, during the last 2 years? And because it did look like at some stage it was going to be, this catastrophic scenario that many of us so-called conspiracy theorists had predicted, and now we're kind of like we've been sideswiped with this sort of pause. It's a good time to pause in many respects, in terms of just pulling ourselves away from the map and just going, okay, all of this stuff, I can't control any of it at the end of the day. And as it kind of stimulates our intellectual impulse, if you like, to scrutinize it all, but at the end of the day, we have no control over it, do we?
Yeah, we kind of need to get around to putting our noses to the map of creating a world for fully functional, fully integrated, and fully realized individuals as a premise for coexistence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very, very true. So as we round things up here, Michael, I wonder if you could just share with the audience, with the listeners, how they can find out more about you and your book.
Thank you. Yes, I've just put out the audiobook. The title of the book is Modern Masculinity for the Conscious Man, and it's primarily aimed at younger men, sort of in their 20s and early 30s, but older men, I'm sure, can get something out of it too. It gives a very coherent and complex and complete picture of the world in which younger men operate these days, and also paints a picture of this new world that we can maybe one day hope to inhabit. People can find it on, Amazon and Audible.
Right. Excellent. Thank you very much for that. And thank you so much for joining us today on Discerning Consciousness, Michael. It's been a fascinating conversation, as always. And thank you to all the listeners. Thank you for joining us today. I hope you've been able to take something from our musings, because on the one hand, it is a very challenging time that we're living through right now, but it is fascinating as well, and there are lots of opportunities, I think, to take life in a new direction once we can just throw off the yoke of oppression, so to speak. So I'm sure I'll speak to you again soon, Michael. So thank you all again, and I'll speak to you all again soon. Bye for now.